You know, it's important to get the biology of BT right, and even though we've been hearing a lot about nematodes, BT is the most successful microbial control agent, and as most of you, I think, know, the toxins from the endotoxins from BT have been used in transgenic plants, and it's now a multi-billion dollar industry, and in the United States, we plant about 50 million acres of BT crop, so it's important to get the biology right. Now, this paper is...
Actually, I have a question of my own. I think you indicated that the pet dogs had higher infection, at 20% versus 15% of the stray dogs. So were you actually surveying the pet dogs only in the area of the three sites, and then the stray dogs all over town?
No, the same area.
Okay.
Interesting. But we did not finish yet investigation of stray dogs. We need some more number.
Right, but you never found dogs, stray dogs, or pet dogs that actually had clinical indication
not
of visceral leishmaniasis.
Very rare.
Okay.
Wrong question.
Yep. Last question.
What do you think we can speculate are the reasons behind the reemergence?
No, I understand what.
No, the microphone.
Oh. you know, I cannot explain it. Maybe it was because of, I mentioned, because of that critical like situation in Georgia in the past 15 years. There were some problems, some social problems and economic problems, and maybe because of these, the one reason can be that many like stray dogs from rural areas moved to Tbilisi, starving without food because of this situation. It's difficult to say now.
Thank you, Eka.
Thank you.
Collaboration with Certis USA, who made the nematodes, and they got out of the business, and Becker Underwood makes them now. Ed Lewis, UC Davis, and his graduate student Amanda Hodson are involved. My technicians, Pat Noble, Richard Gill, the now defunct California Pistachio Commission sponsored this, and I'd like to give special thanks to S&J Ranch, where most of this is going on. You see, here is a picture of what I'm not going to talk about, which is tractor-based application. So for most of you who don't know me, and the few that do find it ironic that I'm doing anything with nematodes, let me give you a little bit of a brief history of this project. What we're targeting here is the overwintering population. So this is the use of nematodes to augment sanitation. We're not directly protecting a crop. Instead, we're knocking down the population during the winter in order to have an impact two or three generations down the line. Since we're dealing with California, we're dealing with a winter application. The ideal time slot by trial and error is really early February, where you can tie it into the rainy season. Ironically, when we're talking about winter applications, it's really critical in that first 24 to 48 hours that the nighttime temperature does not really go below 34. And it seems counterintuitive to people not from California. We really don't want the daytime temperature on the berm to be above 90 degrees during the winter time. Why is that? When the leaves are off the canopy and you're dealing with the totally bare soil and you have that sunlight beating down, you get temperatures of 110 degrees in hot spots in early February. I've recorded them. And basically, I've been looking at chemigation for the past 3 years, because if you're putting them out through the irrigation system, nematodes become quite economically competitive. If you figure just an application cost for a tractor is about $24 to $26 per acre, and you have a material cost of about $30 per acre, that's not economical. If you cut out the labor, suddenly you have a treatment that's competitive with any chemical on the market. In terms of the target, this is a navel orange worm. There is no diapause. It will develop sporadically, intermittently through the winter time, whenever the temperature goes above 55 degrees. and you can get different generation, different instars in the same nut. Yeah, oh, I'm supposed to use this. See this little tiny dot right over here? That's the second instar larva. So you're dealing with multiple hits on the nut, and everything is just sporadically developing along. So this is another consequence. All the generations overlap at some point in time. This appetizing bucket is our material. You can see that I'm dealing with a highly sophisticated application technique. Basically, you take these packets, it's a wonderful formulation, dump them in 5 gallon buckets of water, let them slowly dissolve. I try not to put more than 12 in a bucket because I don't want to kick over a bucket that has $1,000 worth of material in it. So my de facto threshold is about when the bucket's worth $400, I quit. There's my sophisticated stirring tool. I can never remember to bring anything with me, so we're breaking branches off to kind of swish it around. And you can see that we're observing all the really good safety practices here, no gloves. And basically what we're doing here is you put it into the irrigation system. The most important thing about doing this is turn the screen washer off before you pour it in. Otherwise, it'll be sprayed rhythmically in the face every 4 seconds. So we have everything going. Preferably, you get the water running for about 2 hours, so it's cooling down the berm. It's getting everything nice and wet. You take the filters off. You remember to turn the screen washer off, and you pour your buckets in. And depending on the distance traveled, the nematodes will start coming out through the micro-sprinklers anywhere from about 2 minutes to 20 minutes. I did applications where the pumping station was about 2 miles away, and that took about 20, 25 minutes before it got to the orchard. So in terms of sounding like a scientist for a minute, what we're dealing here with micro-sprinklers, their throw is about a radius of 6.5 feet in each direction, so you're covering per micro-sprinkler about 12 square meters. Overall, you're covering about 70% of the berm because you're not getting perfect coverage with the water. And there's gaps here and there and leakage. 20% of the pistachio industry is set up to use this technique, so that would be about 30,000 acres. The hope from the industry point of view is if we can bridge it over into almonds, where we could probably get about 200,000 acres that are set up for this. And I typically have the sprinklers run for 8 hours, so each one is putting out 48 gallons of water. You translate that to, it's about 4,000 gallons per acre. And if you kept me later, I'll tell you how many acre feet that is. Talking back to temperature, as I said, the soil surface is an incredibly harsh environment. And this is an application I did back in 2005, and I had probes out at about 1/2 inch to 1 inch below the surface, and you can see the daily fluctuations. So you have a spread of 60 plus degrees. That red line up on the top, basically if I put it out this day, it would have been fine because it was cloudy. What happened, the nematodes arrived the next day. It was a beautiful cloudless day, and the berms were heating up to over 90 degrees, that particular treatment failed. Another thing when you're evaluating this, it could be that I'm doing some of the largest nematode trials in the world right now, is the challenge of scale. Typically what I'm doing is I'm treating, let's say, a 160 acre block, doing about 400 to 600 acres each year. One row is 1/2 mile long. And you're putting this out onto the berm, and the berm on each side is 3 feet. You start doing the math. So this one year, I basically treated a line that was 218 miles long by 3 feet wide. And the problem is, how do you really go about sampling along that with that variation? And again, this is a post-harvest treatment, so you're not really looking at this point to see what next year's damage is. So the way we kind of take a look at the efficacy here is we're putting out petri plates. We're looking for nematodes in the droplets. We're putting out larvae, looking for hits on that. In some trials, what I do is before application, I'll collect 100,000 nuts. After application, do the same thing from the same area, look at adult emergence. By now, I've probably looked at 1,800 pounds of nuts, or else we put out infested sentinels, both in control and treated plots. in terms of results, the first year up here, this was by tractor application, and we had a reduction of 59%. We also tried chemigation, and we had a 79% reduction in adult emergence, which made me think, wow, this is a really good technique. Let's start looking at that. Next year, I had 1,000 acres signed up. Every day I put it out, it was our rainiest winter. Got about an inch and a half of rain that night. Nematodes like water, not that much water. Most of the treatment got washed away. I had to pool things out of about 200,000 nuts. We got a reduction of about 29%. Next year, I was a little more cautious and decided to do this in a couple of different counties. Over here, we're using sentinels as our target and looking at survival between treated and control. Got almost 39.5% reduction. And again, in terms of the industry, they're used to anything close to 50% they're happy with. The difference over here is I was also, we did this in another area with a really good ground cover, a lot of leaves, a lot of shelter from UV, and you can see here the reduction was 60%. And over here I got approached by an almond grower and they just wanted to try it. And they said they had 60, 80 acres and they wanted to put it out by chemigation. So they collected the almonds about 4 hours before we put the application out. We had 20,000 almonds or so, looked at adult emergence, came back 8 days later, collected another 21,000 off the ground, and you can see we had a reduction of 28%. So again, it's promising. This is probably what the industry would like to do.
2 minutes.
Okay. So in conclusion, really, if you're not from California, it sounds strange, but early February is your optimal time for application. The system can work in pistachios. Again, at this point, there are no chemicals that you're competing with, and you can make it affordable. Almonds are going to require a lot more research. Evaluation is challenging just because of the tremendous area involved and the philosophy of what it is that you're trying to measure. As I said, the cost is prohibitive at probably $32 per acre, but if you look at it by 1 acre, we'll treat two, it kind of drops down, and that's why you really need to do it by chemigation. And education is essential. If you don't spend a heck of a lot of time with these growers, educating them about how to put these things out, it's a guaranteed failure. On the other hand, they really like the fact that there aren't any safety precautions. And with that, I probably have time for one question.
Yeah, there's time for, it's 1 minute for questions.
Any questions? Yes?
What was the species?
Okay, this is Steinernema carpocapsi, and we're targeting the navel orange worm, and that's Amyloides transitella. We also looked at Steinernema feltii, but carpocapsi really works better because you're dealing with a target that's really on the surface. And again, we're doing it as a ground application. We're not spraying the trees. Yes, Don.
So I have two questions. One, do you have any plan to try finding Maria Rob, just because of the high temperature limitations that you have? And the, sorry, go ahead.
No, I could. Part of it also is carpocapsi is the cheapest, but I've worked with Larry. You know, there are others. If I was a nematode person, I'd be spending a lot of time trying to optimize the species. Instead, I've gotten involved in holistic control and have to look at the chemicals too, but I will move that way. With that.
Thanks, Jim.
This is a picture of symptoms of the tomato yellow leaf curl virus transmitted by this insect. And it's actually a very important disease, and we cannot grow tomatoes outside greenhouses because of this disease. The insect also transmits other viruses, new viruses in Israel, in cucurbits. Bemisia is considered today a species complex, and it includes about 20 biotypes that were identified worldwide, and they differ genetically and biologically, and they basically distinguished only based on a biochemical or molecular markers. We usually use microsatellites to distinguish between the biotypes that we have in Israel. So the ones that we have in Israel are the B biotype, which is considered the cosmopolitan and the very fecund, and it usually takes over the Q biotype unless you use lots of insecticides, because the Q biotype is known to develop a resistance very fast, and then if you apply insecticides, you will find the Q biotype. And this is what we find always when we during the season of cotton, for example. So the female usually lays eggs on the lower side of the leaf. The eggs hatch to a crawler, then it develops through 4 and infill stages, and then the adult hatches again. If you look closely to the on the nymphs, you see these two yellow dots, and these are called bacteriosomes, and inside there are lots of bacteria, and these are the primary symbionts of Mimesia called the Portiera, and they are very essential for the whitefly, and actually the whitefly cannot live if they are not vertically transmitted from the mother to the offspring. Besides these symbionts, there are other secondary symbionts which we actually don't know what they do exactly for the whitefly. There are some evidence for these secondary symbionts from other insects that we know they can induce reproductive manipulations, and they can affect the fitness of the insects. So in the whitefly, we know about 6 secondary symbionts. I'm going to show you some quick pictures about these symbionts and their special localization in nymphs. And I'm showing here the nymph and the two yellow dots just to for orientation. So this is the fish localization of Hamiltonella, which co-localizes with Portiera, which is here in red. Hamiltonella is in green. This is Arsenophonus. It also co-localizes with the primary symbiont Portiera in the bacteriosomes. Rickettsia localizes outside the bacteriosome most of the life of the whitefly. Wolbachia basically localizes inside the bacteriosome. Cardinium and Frechea are two secondary symbionts that are not found in Israel. This is a